And we'll continue our discussion of the AP-AOL Black Voices poll with our regular roundtable. Joining us today from our New York bureau, we've got Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post. At member station WGBH in Boston, Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the city's television show Beat the Press. And we've got Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at New York University. Thanks to all of you for being with us. And the thing I have in my mind that's a real question on the AOL Black Voices poll, and Callie, maybe you can go first on this, is Black Americans are not really that much more likely to vote for Black candidates. That was surprising to me. What about you?
Yes and no. I think because people have gotten to the point of really looking at what is the candidate saying. I think there are some places, for example, in Tennessee, for many years, the Fords have had a dynasty going on there. And that's as much that can be supported by their being Black as much as what they've done for the community. So when you get outside of that, where people feel like they're not being served by the folks, they start to look at what are they saying and what do they stand for. And I think that's why you've seen some crossover from what would be considered traditional Democrats moving over to vote for Republicans they think speak to them in other ways.
Robert, you know, sometimes being Black is a deal breaker for white voters when they look at a politician. It seems as if the other direction, African Americans are not as concerned with whether or not they put an African American in office. I mean, first of all, do you buy the results? And secondly, what do you think of them?
I think the results are pretty accurate. I think we've known for a long time, for example, that Black Americans had a pretty low opinion of the Bush administration, and it's kind of continued from there. But it's interesting you say that a candidate being Black can be a deal breaker for white voters. I think it's also sometimes the case, and we may find this out in the race in Maryland, for example. Being Republican can be a deal breaker for Black voters if the candidate is Black. So that actually goes to speak to the fact that Black voters also, you know, will look at the whole candidate. They'll look at whether he or she completely represents their values. And obviously, if you've got a very far right Republican like Alan Keyes, Black voters are not going to go to him. If you've got somebody a little bit more moderate like Michael Steele, who's running in Maryland, they may look at him. In fact, he got the support of a number of Black elected officials in Maryland this past week. But at the same time, whether that's going to translate to the Black voters across the board, not necessarily.
Marcelo, when you look at the part of the findings that said that Black Americans, I mean, something like 88%, if I'm recalling correctly, just from our segment, are suspicious of or don't like the president, where does that leave a certain demographic group, in this case Black Americans, to go? If people are so overwhelmingly disapproving of the leadership of one side, are the Democrats doing a good enough job to counterbalance that and to provide options? And if not, what could be done?
Well, that's in fact a paradox, because there is such widespread discontent with the current leadership, with the president. The African-American population, in a way, needs to turn to the Democratic alternatives, and there's always the danger of being taken for granted. This is where the African-American voter and the Latino voter are somewhat different. Latinos have split their votes in the past. It's not at all clear that this will be the case tomorrow. That, in a way, makes both parties have to work harder for their vote.
Marcelo, I want to move along to another topic. Big news this weekend. Former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein and two of his senior aides were sentenced to death by hanging. He was on trial for crimes against humanity in the massacre of nearly 150 Shiites after a failed assassination attempt in 1982. Now, the verdict set off protests and celebrations in Iraq, which has become increasingly divided by sectarian violence. And so let's listen to what the president of the United States had to say.
And today we witnessed a landmark event in the history of Iraq. Saddam Hussein was convicted and sentenced to death by the Iraqi High Tribunal.
But former Georgia Senator Max Cleland wasn't so happy with the situation. He warned against making too much of the verdict.
The truth of the matter is, though, you can hang him from the rooftops, and it's not going to change anything. We captured him 3 years ago. Hadn't changed anything. It made everything worse.
Marcelo, what do you make of those statements?
Well, in a way, it was a foregone conclusion that the case against Saddam Hussein was a very strong case, and in some ways, the shocking news would have been if he hadn't been convicted to death by hanging. I think the issue remains that how does this play in the context of what is unfolding in Iraq? We know that this today there's a state of siege in Baghdad. Meaning today, this should have been a day of celebration for the Iraqi people, theoretically. Yet what we have is deep suspicion, deep divides, deep chaos moving forward.
Robert, could this actually put U.S. troops in danger if the sectarian violence just gets pushed up by this announcement?
I think so. I mean, what we've seen is there have been a number of what were perceived as going to be sort of possible, benchmarks or turning points, I guess you could say, along this, whether it was when we captured Saddam or when it was when we had a series of elections and the passing of a constitution and so forth. And at least, at least on a superficial level, it hasn't really done anything to curtail the violence. So just the fact that he has been sentenced to death, or he will be eventually executed after the next trial, sometime down the road. The only thing that's really going to control the violence is crafting some kind of a political solution. Right now, everything else is just background noise at this point.
And Callie, I think that, what I'd like to ask you is about the question of hanging and execution. I mean, the U.S. is a nation which executes prisoners, but in many parts of the world, many Western parts of the world, that's completely outlawed. And we've had extradition problems with other countries because they're like, we can't send someone back to be executed. Is the idea of executing the Iraqi leader justice, or could that actually provoke something worse than, say, locking him up for life imprisonment?
Well, it's definitely going to, in the second part of your question, I think, is definitely going to provoke something worse. I mean, we've already seen the beginnings of that in the country, but also the initial responses from people around the world, from other countries, saying, okay, yeah, he needs to be punished, but hanging him is really not the way one wants to go. I mean, and even in this country, we still struggle around capital punishment and whether or not state-sponsored killing is something that we want to say is really justice. What we want to have justice be is punishment. But the question is whether or not punishment by death, certainly in the way that they're intending to do it with Saddam Hussein, is the way to go. So I think that there is going to be a great divide about the manner in which he is punished, in this case put to death, and there's certainly going to be more violence within the country about the fact that he's going to be punished or he's been sentenced. And remember, this is going to be appealed, so we've still got months before anything actually happens where there's time to foment more tension in the country.
And it should be kept in mind, though, that the Middle East, though, is one of the areas of the world where the death penalty is accepted.
By the way, Tony Blair has come out against the idea of death by hanging, and that's, of course, very paradoxical, given that he is our most supportive ally in the effort in Iraq.
Well, one final topic I want to move on to. Barack Obama mania has been sweeping the country, but Stanley Crouch, who's a columnist and a critic, is just saying, no way. It's not about Barack Obama being black because he is not black like Stanley. In his New York Daily News column, Stanley Crouch said that Obama doesn't share a heritage with the majority of black Americans who descend from slaves. He does go on to say that thinking about one's ethnic background is better than another is absurd. So, Robert, I know that you have a blog. What were your thoughts on Crouch's thoughts?
Well, I mean, I thought it was a little bit curious because I mean, I saying this as I mean, I was born in Trinidad in the West Indies, like a large segment of the broadly speaking, African American population within the United States. And I mean, the fact is, Obama, even though his mother was white and his father was Kenyan, he still grew up within the construct of a country where race is still a factor. I mean, he I'm sure had to deal with the N-word like I did when I started coming to the United States. Still had to deal with being viewed suspiciously if you're just walking around a store, for example. So I mean, I think it. Crouch makes a legitimate point, saying that there are ethnic distinctions within the black community, where West Indians may not necessarily see the world exactly the same way as Black Americans whose families have been here for generations. I will respect that, but I mean, I think it's still very clear that whatever the shade that Obama is, he is still broadly speaking a Black American man.
Absolutely. I mean, I think let me just clarify a little bit of what Stanley Crouch had to say. He talked about Barack Obama throwing his hat in the ring for the presidency. And he says, if so, he will have to run as the son of a white woman and an African immigrant. If we then end up with him as our first black president, he will have come into the White House through a side door, which might at this point be the only one that's open. So, Callie, what that says to me is that in some way Stanley Crouch is critiquing an America where the son of an immigrant might be able to do better than the son of or the great-great-grandson of a slave.
I guess he is in some way. Hey, that's been true in a lot of instances. We'll recall during the Civil Rights Movement that Africans could come to towns and go right to the quote-unquote white-owned hotels and be accepted, whereas Black Americans could not. So there, to some degree, there's always been the other seems more interesting, even if they are ethnically and racially aligned with the folks who have been here the whole time. What I would say is, as long as Barack Obama, who has certainly been here and had the African-American experience, if not, as authentic as someone born in Birmingham, say, like Condoleezza Rice, who declares that she had never experienced a lot of the stuff that Robert just outlined. I mean, I think black folks can certainly respond to somebody who understands the experience and admits that it happens, as opposed to someone who's having some amnesia about it, as in Condoleezza Rice. So, I think this is maybe it's a tempest in a teapot. I don't know. It's an interesting perspective, but I think for a lot of folks, it's just not going to make that much of a difference in the end.
Marcelo, we've only got a minute left. What do you think?
This is moving forward going to be a transforming issue given the growth of the immigrant origin African and Afro-Caribbean population in the United States. In the state of New York, now roughly two-thirds of all blacks have an immigrant origin, and we see a continued growth in the African, Afro-Caribbean immigrant origin population of the United States. So this will transform fundamental questions about what it means to be black as the immigrant origin population blends their own experiences to that of the traditional African-American population.
All right. Perfect place to leave it. Marcelo Suarez-Orozco, professor of globalization and education at NYU, Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator, and Robert George of the New York Post. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Thank you, Farai.